Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
On June 23, 1938, Lois Jotter found herself stuck on what was known as the most dangerous river in the world. She was 24 years old, studying botany at the University of Michigan, and Lois had come along with another woman, Elzada Clover. The idea was to raft more than 600 miles down the Green and Colorado rivers through the Grand Canyon to document the plant life in the region. No one had ever done it. The interaction of those living systems in that remote place was pretty much a complete mystery. But back to June 23rd. The journalist Melissa Savigny tells the story in a new book, Lois on This Dangerous River. Oh, and it was night.
And she's with an extremely inexperienced crew of people. They've spent about 4 days going down the Green River. No rapids, it's all going fine. And then they reach the Colorado. And everything goes wrong. They're really unprepared for how high the water is and how wild the rapids are. And they're all standing there on the shoreline. They've tied up the boats. They're looking at the very first rapid. And they're trying to figure out, like, how are we actually going to do this? And Lois's boat has not been tied properly. And it pulls away. And it takes off down the river without them. This is pretty bad, because they're going to be very hungry if they lose this boat. And so Lois Jotter and her boatman, whose name is Don Harris, jump into one of the other boats and they chase it. And so her first experience with whitewater, with the Colorado River Rapids, is chasing this runaway boat. And they chase the boat about 4 miles, and they find it, you know, aground on a sandbar. Luckily for them, it's still intact. It has everything in it. And by this time, they're pretty widely separated from the rest of the crew. Night is falling. Don Harris decides he's going to walk back upriver and tell everybody that it's okay, that they found the boat. And he leaves Lois there. And she waits and she waits, and night falls, and Don Harris never comes back, and she doesn't know why. And she described what happened later in a letter to her mother in this wonderful detail. She kind of set up camp. She made a campfire. She toasted some bread. She put some jam on it. She makes herself a bed. The river keeps rising, and she keeps having to wake up in the middle of the night and move her bed a little further back. And she's just listening to the noises of the night around her. And I think there's a temptation sometimes when you read about something like this to project your own experiences. And my own temptation is to imagine that she would have been frightened. But she wasn't. She wrote in that letter to her mother that she had a lovely time. And I loved that about her. I love that she upturned my own expectation of how she would respond to a moment like that. And that's really what made me want to write this book. I'm so grateful to her for leaving behind her diary and leaving behind her letters. She kept everything that had to do with this 1938 Colorado River expedition. You could tell that it was an incredibly important part of her life. And I'm very grateful to her and her mentor, Elzada Clover, for saving all of that material, because it enabled me to tell their story with such wonderful detail.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Melissa Savigny is talking about her new book. It's called Brave the Wild River. Savigny is a science journalist at the Arizona Public Radio station, KNAU.
I ran across the names of these two women just by chance, Elzada Clover and Lois Jotter, and I learned that they had run the Colorado River in 1938, that they made the first formal collection of botany there. And I was shocked that I had never heard of them before. I'm an Arizonan. I've been here all my life, and I really thought I knew quite a bit about Colorado River history. And yet somehow I had never encountered their names. And so I was intrigued, but I was busy, as we all are, with other things, and I put off really digging more into their story. Until around Christmas time in 2018, I went into the Special Collections Department at Northern Arizona University. I was not thinking about the story. I was going in to see an exhibit of Grand Canyon photographs that they had just put up. And there on the wall was a picture of Lois and Alzada on their 1938 river trip. And I was standing there watching, you know, looking at this picture. And the curator of the exhibit walked by, and I said to him very, very much on a whim that I was thinking of writing something about their story. And he told me to wait, and he disappeared back into the archive, and he came out with a cardboard box and put it on the table, and he took out all this bright pink bubble wrap inside the box. And inside the box was Lois Jotter's 1938 river running hat. And it was a really cool moment for me. It's, you know, it's kind of like more of a helmet, which tells you something about her state of mind. And around the brim, she had all of her companions sign their names on this hat. And she kept it her entire life, and she donated it to this archive, or I think her son did after she passed away. It just made their story become very real to me, you know, this tangible piece of history. And that was actually the day that I started to write this book.
How much of it was your interest in these women and what they were trying to do and their stories? And how much of it was also your interest in, you know, the ecology of the river, the way it looked in 1938 compared to the way it looked, you know, years later as you're thinking about this story? You know, because you've spent a decent amount of time as a reporter sort of writing about the river and the ecosystem and all of those kinds of things. Was it a mixture of all those things?
It was. It was certainly both of those things. I have a deep connection to the Colorado River as the river that sustains me here in Arizona. But I was drawn into the story originally because of the characters, because I had never heard of these women, because they had such compelling characters. As soon as I started reading their letters and their diaries, their voices were so strong and distinct, and they just seemed like fascinating people. And I wanted to get to know them. And so that's what originally drew me into it, you know, especially feeling like these were the kinds of women that I would have liked to have read about when I was younger. You know, I always wanted to be a scientist when I grew up, and I didn't have that many inspirational stories about the women who had come before me. So that drew me in. But as a science journalist, I'm always looking for ways to kind of inform people about the places where they live in compelling ways. And so I had this adventure story, I had these compelling characters, and I could use them to kind of package together this bigger story about how the ecology of this region has changed over the last half century.
You begin talking about botany and how, at least at a certain point in American history, it was the only branch of natural history that was seen as suitable for ladies. Talk a little bit about that, because you mentioned how being a botanist wasn't really thought of as a serious career pursuit, but it was sort of acceptable if you were an amateur, if that's how you thought of it.
That's right. This is sort of the attitude of the 1800s the idea that, you know, women can't do zoology because that would involve shooting animals, and they can't do geology because that would involve lifting heavy rocks, you know. Yeah. The only thing that's open to them is botany, because essentially the idea was botany is like collecting wildflowers, and that's a very acceptable thing for a young lady to do. Mm-hmm. So kind of really all through the 1800s, young women could go out and they could collect plants and they could press them, and then they would send them to universities where kind of the real scientific work was done, you know,
right?
like the formal scientific work. This is such a fascinating history to me, because right around the time that Alzada Clover and Lois Jotter enter the scene, it's all changing.
Right.
Botany's becoming this much more professional, laboratory-based science. And as that happens, women get shut out. You know, it stops being acceptable for women to be botanists. And so they were kind of entering the field at a bad time, and it was extremely unusual for women to get PhDs in anything, let alone in a science. And so already you know something about their determination and their grit and their passion for plants, that they were both. Alzada Clover just recently got her PhD, and Lois Jotter was on her way to getting one.
It's so interesting you write about before it changes, just the idea of how botany was thought of. One woman mentions that botany is peculiarly adapted to females. How, as you say, the virtues of botany were like women's virtues, because there's innocence and gentility, and flowers reflect the same kind of qualities of women, you know, purity and loveliness. I mean, this is the sort of the sentiment, I guess, that's sort of before things shift anyway. And here's the other part that I thought was really interesting about all of this, that if you were a boy or a man interested in plant collecting, something was wrong with you. You were thought of as unmanly.
Right. Yeah. Yep. The stereotype cuts both ways for sure. And it's funny that this, you know, this really focuses on the idea of flowers, right? Like women could collect flowers because that was, a feminine thing to do, and men could not collect flowers. And that was really kind of the attitude of the late 1800s and early 1900s. But, you know, Elzeta Clover comes along, she wants to collect cactus. Mm-hmm. And I really love that about her, because it defies all of those stereotypes, right? They're not fat, fragile, or lovely, or beautiful. Like, they're cactus, you know? They're pretty tricky to collect. They're sort of unlovely plants. And I think that says a lot about her personality, the kind of woman she was, that she really did want to go out into these rugged, wild desert places and pick up plants that other people didn't think women should be looking at all.
What was she like? You mentioned her personality. Liked whiskey, liked to swim and hunt and ride a horse. I liked this part. You talk about how she described her own sort of personality. She preferred gentlemanly to ladylike. What does that mean, do you think?
I don't know. I know that she occasionally used more masculine language to describe herself. I know that she had a lot of hobbies that weren't really considered appropriate for women of her era.
Yeah.
I know that she had no interest in getting married or becoming a mother. Of course, this meant that the press, when they started talking about her, dismissed her as being a spinster.
Yep.
But she never used that word to refer to herself. She preferred using the word bachelor. She was fascinating. I loved everything about her personality. She was really forging her own path at a time when that was not encouraged for women to do.
What was the dream? I guess before we get to the expedition, because that comes to her in a moment here that we'll talk about, but the dream was like she wanted to make a field study of all the cacti in the Southwest, right?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Not ambitious at all, right?
Yeah. Right. That's a tall order.
Yeah. And I don't think she ever really completed that dream. That was kind of a lifetime amount of work for her. But she would just, you know, she wasn't getting any funding or any support. She would just drive out in the summers. She would go west and start collecting cacti. That's kind of how it all started for her.
Well, and it gets us to the part of the story where she meets a man named Norman Nevels. And this really sort of moves the story into another place. Talk about when she meets Norman, because she's there in, Mexican Hat.
Yeah, she's out in Mexican Hat, Utah. It's the summer of 1937. She's collecting cactus, like she likes to do. And there's only one place to stay, which is the Mexican Hat Lodge. Right. Even today, it's a tiny, tiny little town. And the owner of the lodge is this man, Norman Nevels, who, it turns out, has this kind of crazy dream of his own. He wants to start a commercial river running business in the Grand Canyon. And this is not being done. People are not just running the Grand Canyon like they do today. There's no way to sign up for an expedition through the Grand Canyon.
Right.
So this is kind of a wild idea. And he doesn't really have any experience at this point in his life. He's been taking people on river trips down his local river, which is the San Juan River. It has a couple of small rapids, but it's nothing like the Grand Canyon. And so he doesn't really have the experience for this, but he's got this idea, the way Clover has this idea, like big dreams, both of them. And the way Clover described it is they're just talking one evening at the lodge, and they come up with this plan. They think, well, we could just do this together. Norm's going to recruit some boatmen and build some boats, and Clover's going to go back to Michigan and recruit some scientists, and they're going to go on this wild Colorado River trip, and Clover's going to make her cactus collection. And so that's how it all begins.
The first idea, though, that you mentioned was she figures, let's take mules into the canyon. Norman says, that's not going to work. We have to do it by boat. Did they realize what that – I mean, even he knew. I mean, he was running the San Juan, but as you say, there wasn't much to that when you compare it to the Colorado going down the Grand. Did they have any idea what that – I mean, people had talked about how dangerous this could be. What did they know about that?
I think they had some idea, but not a very good idea. I mean,
right.
Most of the accounts – and both of them kind of did their research. You know, they both talked about tracking down the books that they could find about the trip through the Colorado River through Grand Canyon. The downside is those books were often written – you know, there were about a dozen expeditions that had done the Grand Canyon between John Wesley Powell going down in 1869 and Clover and Neville's coming along. So not very many. You're talking about 70 years and just a dozen expeditions. And some of those had come back and published accounts, but they were often very, like, over-dramatic accounts, you know? They were really leaning into the danger of it. So to be honest, I think Clover at least had the impression that it was a really dangerous thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, all of the accounts she read really emphasized, you know, there had been deaths, there had been drownings, there had been capsized boats. You know, everybody said that it was just a really wild trip. And so despite having that kind of outsized view of the danger, she decides she wants to do it anyway. And that's pretty incredible.
Melissa Savigny, she reports on science and technology for KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona. Her book is Brave the Wild River, the untold story of two women who mapped the botany of the Grand Canyon. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the story of the two women who first mapped the botany of the Grand Canyon. In 1938, no one was exactly sure just what kind of plant life lived in that part of the world, or really how the ecosystem there worked. Elzada Clover and Lois Jotter wanted to figure this out, but it would require a 43-day expedition, 600 miles down the Green and Colorado Rivers. Savigny says it would be an essential record of a region that was changing fast. Her book is called Brave the Wild River. What did scientists know about the Grand Canyon and the Colorado River at the time? Because you write about how it wasn't really clear just how the canyon had formed, and the river didn't seem like it behaved like a normal river. So it seems like there were all these kinds of questions about how the system behaved there, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the science was still very much in its infancy. There really hadn't been serious scientific expeditions. There had been John Wesley Powell, but he discovered that just staying alive was going to be a task enough and didn't really get to do as much of the science as he wanted.
Yeah.
Of course, indigenous people have a very deep understanding of this river ecosystem and its ecology. But for Western science, it was all kind of a bit of a blank spot. It seemed like a mystery to them. And I was really fascinated with, you know, more than that, the kind of the public view of the Grand Canyon in the 1930s was sort of hilarious. I mean, people thought that there were like herds of horses down there that had been cut off from the outside world for so long that they had de-evolved into the size of coyotes. You know, like there were these wild, wild stories about the Grand Canyon in the press. And I don't know how many of them Clover and Jotter believed, but there was definitely this kind of mystique over the place.
The other thing I think is interesting about 1938 is, as you say, the region was really changing fast. That seems an important part of the story.
Yeah, this was really kind of a pivotal moment, the 1930s, because the big dams are going in. So Hoover Dam has just been completed, and it's you know, massive reservoir Lake Mead is starting to fill up. And that's kind of the start of the dam building era on the Colorado River. You know, as Clover and Jotter discovered, non-native plants were starting to move into the region. Tourism was starting to pick up. You know, there were all of these changes, and they were kind of riding the front edge of that wave. They were right at the beginning of all of these incredible changes that were really going to put their stamp on the ecology of the region.
Let's talk about Lois Jotter, who will come into the story here in a moment. I think we need to know a little bit about her mother and her father. Her mother had a love of tinkering. She had won this medal for mechanical drawing. So she herself was interesting. Like, she had seemed to have a a curious personality, mm-hmm. And was indulged by her parents, it seems, also to like explore. It seems anyway, I guess. And then her father, he's a forester, but also a conservationist. How does that mixture inform little Lois, I guess?
Yeah. She was raised in kind of a fascinating family. She was born in kind of the redwoods of California, spent a lot of time outdoors with her parents. And as you say, her mother had come from this long line of engineers, including female engineers. Her father worked for the U.S. Forest Service and was really kind of steeped in very early ideas about conservation and protection of natural resources. And it seems that all of that kind of came home to the dinner table. You know, they had conversations over dinner about these ideas. And so from a very young age, the age of 7, I think, she decided that she wanted to be a botanist and really pursued that dream her whole life. And I think her father especially was an incredible influence on her. I could see that reflected in her ideas about conservation and environmental protection, which feel like very modern ideas. Yeah. You know, I think she was getting that all from her father working at the Forest Service and working even briefly with Aldo Leopold, who's now considered kind of the father of modern conservation. So she was lucky that she was raised in a family that really supported her dreams.
Well, you also mentioned that she grew up looking at the broken mountainsides, as you say, and the eroded streams that had happened in the gold rush days. So she could see the consequences of environmental degradation. But would you describe her as a conservationist at the time? Did she think that way, do you think?
It's hard to pinpoint it because, there was no such thing as an environmentalist, right?
Right.
And so I'm not sure she would describe herself that way. But I do remember in a letter that she read to her father, she had read a newspaper article that had been talking about conservation as this very newfangled idea. And she was shocked by that. She said, amazing, with all these exclamation points. Like, to her, it was a very old idea. Like, she had grown up with this idea. And more than the others, I think she had an attitude towards the natural world that we would maybe now call, you know, a conservationist or an environmentalist. You know, she was the only one who really hesitated when they painted their names on the walls of the canyon as they're going down the river. For everybody else, this was a very normal thing to do in the 1930s. But Lois was like, I don't know if that's really the best idea.
How does Elzaida choose her? You know, how does she choose her for this grand idea of going on this expedition? It seems like it was just kind of like, well, I know her, she's a friend, we're going to be in close quarters, I'll pick her.
I mean, to some extent, I think that's it's a more important qualification than people think. If you've never been on a river trip, maybe you don't know how quickly you get on each other's nerves, and how important it is to have somebody that you can live with in close quarters for a long period of time. So she and Lois had lived together in the same house, so they knew each other quite well, and she had to pick a woman, right? She had to find another woman because it's the 1930s. And if Elzaida goes off down the river with a bunch of men, people will say things about that, right? Like, that's not appropriate. So she has to have another woman so they can be each other's chaperones. This probably limits her field quite a bit. Like, she needs a qualified botanist who's female. And I think she hesitates a little bit. I think she's concerned about what it would mean. Like, Elzaida knows herself. She knows she's got this daredevil, adventurous attitude. Yeah. But Lois isn't like that. She's not she's not a daredevil like Elzaida. And I think Elzaida's worried. You know, I mean, this, you know, they could die. Like, that is a real possibility. And so she hesitates. She kind of waffles quite a bit before inviting Lois to come on this trip. But she is very well qualified, both for the botany, for the outdoors work, and for the fact that they know they can stand each other. And Lois jumps on the chance right away. Mm-hmm. She really wants to do it.
But she has to make a pitch to her father, Lois.
She does.
Right?
Yes, she has to pitch this to her father, which she does in the most casual way at the very, very end of an extremely long letter. Oh, by the way, I've been invited to go down the Colorado River. And I'd really like to do it. And she needs her father's support for a couple of reasons. I think one, that's what their relationship was like. They were close. But two, she needs to borrow money from him. Yeah. They've all got to put up $200 to pay for the boats and the supplies. And that's quite a lot of money in 1938. And so she's got to borrow the money from her father. And so she spends a lot of time sending very detailed letters about what this expedition is going to be like. And they're pretty funny because they're kind of lies. I mean, she tells him, Norm Neville's has done this many times before. That is not true. He's never done it before. You know, she tells him, like, the crew's really experienced. There's pretty good maps, you know, like, lots of things to kind of comfort him. And I really don't know how much of this stuff she believed herself and how much she was kind of stretching the truth a little bit in order to make it more acceptable to her father.
Well, her timing is really terrible because then, like, you write about how a week later this article comes out in the Saturday Evening Post about this solo expedition down the Colorado River. And that gets us to another you already mentioned him, but another important character in the story, Buzz Holmstrom. Talk about this part. What is her father sees this article, I guess?
That's right. I mean, everybody sees this article.
Right.
It's in the Saturday
it's in the
Evening
Post. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Everybody reads the Post. And it's a big deal, this, like, big spread on this man who did a solo expedition through the Grand Canyon, the first one on record. And his name is Buzz Holmstrom. And the press really plays him up as this, you know, they even call him a he-man's hero, right? And he's like this manly man. And that is the reason why he was able to do this amazing thing. And so he kind of at the beginning hangs over the story as this sort of like nebulous villain, you know, this villainous presence, because this really puts a damper on Lois and Elzada's plans, you know, especially for Lois, who needs her family's approval. They all read this, they all freak out, they start sending her letters like, maybe this isn't such a good idea, you know, it made the trip sound really frightening. And Lois has to spend a lot of time arguing with them about the fact that she thinks she can do this too.
And of course, Buzz says, women may have their place in the world, but they don't belong in the canyon of the Colorado.
That's right. Of course, he's quoted very widely as saying that women don't belong there. And he's not thinking about Elzada and Lois. He doesn't know them at this point in the story, right? Nobody knows that these two women have cooked up this plan. He's thinking about the story of Bessie Hyde, which is a tragic story from a decade earlier. Two honeymooners, Glenn and Bessie Hyde, attempted to run the Grand Canyon. They made it almost all the way, and then they vanished. And to this day, we don't know what happened to them. And there was a lot of press about this, about the fact specifically that Bessie disappeared. And that's the story that Buzz Holmstrom was referring to when he said that women shouldn't be doing this kind of trip. And so that's the context. That's this, you know, this is just a few months before they're about to launch their trip. All of this hits the press, and it puts a lot of attention on Elzada and Lois and what they plan to do.
What was the condition of the river at the time? And by that, I guess I mean the ecology, actually. Because, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, about how it would come to change. But how would you describe, how did they describe the ecology of that place at the time?
This was so fascinating to me because, you know, they didn't have the vocabulary that we have now. They didn't have the word ecosystem, you know? And yet in the journal that they kept about the plant life, they were making really detailed notes about what today we would think of as ecosystem science. So they would talk about, you know, as they go further and further down the river, they discover what today we would refer to as microhabitats. They didn't have that word either, but they discovered that the plants are really being shaped by these tiny, tiny little changes, things like the slope, the angle of the slope, or the angle of the sunlight. You know, whether there's a spring there or not, that completely changes the plant life if there's a spring welling to the surface. And they're making all of these observations as they're moving downriver and really kind of coming to this sort of nuanced, subtle view of how plants grow, where they grow. And this was pretty different than the prevailing views at the time. You know, there were kind of more oversimplified views of why plants are in particular places that generally looked at it as like a factor of climate. And they were really looking at things in a much more complicated way. They were looking at how things like how mice would stuff their cheeks with seeds and climb up onto the high canyon walls and deposit some of those seeds and not eat them all. And then some of them would sprout. You know, they were thinking about how do these plants get into these little nooks and crannies? And I really loved watching kind of how their minds worked as they moved down the river.
You also mentioned that I'll say that was interested in kind of testing this idea of a man named Sehart Merriman, who had believed that North America consisted of these life zones. And in some ways, she was thinking, oh, this may be a good time to sort of, test that idea?
That's right. Yeah, this was kind of, you can think of it as like a proto-ecosystem concept, you know, it was this idea of life zones. And this guy named Sehart Merriam had come out to Arizona. He had hiked the Grand Canyon, and he had come up with this, you know, simplified system of where plants grow, where they grow. And it was all based on topography, which is linked to climate. So if you go to the very top of a mountain, you get these, you know, alpine plants, this alpine ecosystem. If you're at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, you're in the desert. And then there's this range of bands of life zones in between. And this was a pretty popular idea at kind of the end of the 1800s. But people had started to question it by the 1930s. And Clover saw this river trip as an opportunity to add some layers of nuance to these ideas. Because, of course, she's descending in elevation as she descends the river. Yeah. And so it's a good chance for her to actually see in kind of more up-close detail how those plants actually shift. And you can see this yourself, by the way, if you ever raft the Grand Canyon. Like, you hit a point on the river where the elevation has shifted just subtly, and all of a sudden there's barrel cactus where there wasn't barrel cactus before. And that happens multiple ways with multiple different plants as she goes down the river. She was the first botanist who really had a chance to see and record that.
Well, and you also mentioned how, you know, they were laser focused on the plants, where I think if you were to first enter the Grand Canyon, and you mentioned how they do, Lois, and I guess they'll say that, didn't pay that much attention to the story of the canyon that is told by those layers in the stone.
That's right.
Like they came for the plants, I think is how you put it.
That's right. Yeah, it was fascinating seeing the Grand Canyon through their eyes as botanists, because I think even today a lot of people who spend time in the Grand Canyon, you know, they're there for the geology, and the geology is spectacular, and you can learn so much from it. But there are plants there, and they're also telling a story.
There's a moment you write about, I guess it's the first rapid they encounter. It's called Badger Creek. It's about 8 miles downriver from the launch point, or at least from Lee's Ferry. And you write about how they could hear the rapid before they saw it. It's a nice bit of writing here that you do. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit about it, because it seems like they – I mean, you talk about this this low reverberation that settled in their chest right behind the breastbone, you know, building to a roar. If anyone's run a river, they sort of know what you're talking about. But say something about this moment, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually drawn from my own experience running the Grand Canyon, which I did as research for this book. I had never done anything like that before. It was my first whitewater rafting trip. Hmm. I knew I had to do it to tell the story right, to really kind of fill in the details that were missing out of their accounts. You know, details like that, like what does it actually feel like to plunge into a rapid? And especially, you know, this is the first rapid they encounter in the Grand Canyon, so it's about halfway through their trip. They're getting tired, and their diaries get thinner and thinner as they go along. Eventually, Lois just stops writing in hers entirely. Like, they're getting exhausted. And so in that latter half, in the Grand Canyon section of the book, there was a lot of questions I had that I needed to fill in. And so that was my experience, first encountering a rapid, like actually feeling it kind of in your chest, you know, and that experience of looking ahead and seeing how the river is just kind of cut off and you can't really see what's beyond the brink. And then you get closer and there's these waves and the boat goes plunging through the waves. I folded in my own experience, my own Grand Canyon trip, into the story so that I could make, you know, it's not details about plot, but it's texture, you know?
Sure.
It's like adding texture to the story.
Well, and the other thing, one of the reasons that Lois and Elzeta were exhausted the further they went along is, how to put this, they were doing all the work. At least they were doing all the cooking, which that's just such a maddening detail, but I guess that's just what was expected.
Yeah, it really was. I was fascinated by that they did all of the cooking in addition to their botany work and a lot of other work as well. There were a lot of letters that Norm and Alzada exchanged before the trip, making plans, you know, including things like the menu. But there was never a moment when Alzada volunteered or Norm ordered her to do the cooking. That never happened. Yeah. And so the fact that they did all the cooking seemed to be just completely accepted by everybody involved. Like, there was no question about it. I know that Alzada got frustrated as time went on about that. And at one point she writes in her diary, "If I ever do this trip again, I'm going to hire a cook."
Right. Well, we should also mention, as you do in the book, that they weren't the first women down the Colorado. And Alzada was always careful to say she and Lois were the first non-Native women.
That's right,
to boat the Grand Canyon. Talk a little bit about that part, and I guess the kind of indigenous experience, what you learned about, what you could learn about that.
That's right. I mean, these stories come from indigenous oral history. They're not necessarily stories that are written down or in the archaeological record, but that doesn't make them any less valid. And so the oldest story I know of river running on the Colorado is a young Hopi man named Tio, who ran the San Juan River and the Colorado all the way to the ocean. And Hopi and Navajo people who have told me their own stories, their own histories of river running, tell me these are real stories. These are history. These are real people. And I think it's interesting that Alzada Clover seemed to be aware of that. She spent time with the Havasupai people in the canyon the year after this trip. And I suspect that that's maybe part of the reason why she had kind of a richer understanding of indigenous history. And she did always refer to herself as the first non-Native woman to make that trip, I think out of respect for those indigenous oral histories.
One of the things you write about is how they collected these samples, how careful they had to be to document them and to save them and to sort of scoop out the pulp of the – well, talk about the process they had to go through.
Yeah, it was a pretty tedious process, right? They would have to, you know, uproot these plants or cut them and then press them flat between pieces of newspaper. And then they would stack blotting paper around that, which is meant to keep it dry. It didn't work all that well, given the circumstances of a river trip. And then they would stack all of those plants together between two pieces of wood, and they would cinch it tight. And that was called a plant press. And they were creating this as they moved down the river. And pretty tricky work with cactus. I talked to a friend of mine who does botany in the Grand Canyon, and she described that they probably would have been cutting the cactus in half, like the cactus pads on a prickly pear, scooping out all that pulp and then kind of flattening it. But you have to keep all the stickers and the spines intact for identification later. And since they were doing all the cooking, they were doing the botany work mostly very, very early in the morning or very, very late at night, sometimes after the sun had gone down. So difficult, tricky, tedious work. They always took the time to make detailed notes about the species they were finding and the circumstances they were finding them in. And they really achieved quite a lot. I mean, they collected more than 400 species of plants on this trip.
What did those plants tell us about that place? Like, what were the insights that they, you know, beyond just sort of here's this collection, what could they say that collection meant for that place?
I think what's fascinating about this story is that the collection they made is becoming more important with time rather than less, because things are changing really fast. And, you know, a few decades after this trip, Glen Canyon Dam went up at the head of the Grand Canyon. And that's a big dam. It really changed everything about the ecology, both upstream and downstream of this river ecosystem. And so today, a lot of the work that scientists are trying to do in the Grand Canyon is, you know, understanding how it used to look, so that we can understand how could we maybe manage it differently going forward. How could we try to restore some of those natural processes that used to kind of, you know, govern the river's ecology. So it's important to have records, right? Older records of what this river used to look like. And there's certainly multiple ways you can approach that. There's indigenous oral histories. There's lots of scientific records. But for botany, this is the only record. Their collection and their plant list is the only record of the plant life before Glen Canyon Dam went in. So if they hadn't gone on this trip, if they had listened to all the naysayers, we wouldn't really have a good idea of what the botany of the river used to look like before that dam changed everything.
Melissa Sevigny, Her book is Brave the Wild River, the untold story of two women who mapped the botany of the Grand Canyon. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back to our conversation with the science journalist Melissa Savigny. We're talking about her new book, Brave the Wild River. Azeda writes this letter, and in it she says that the old river ruins people for settling down. What did she mean by that?
I think she was restless. I mean, I think she's always been a restless person, yeah. But she comes off the river and just kind of plunges into this deep depression, yeah. Which I think a lot of people experience when they come off a trip like that. I certainly did. You know, I really connected with her because she just wanted to go back. You know, she didn't want to go back to her old life of teaching and grading papers. Like, she just wanted to be on the river again. I think she struggled with that maybe for years, maybe for the rest of her life, like that sense of restlessness of just wanting to get back to the river, which she never did. She never rafted it a second time.
Yeah. I have to say it's a bummer reading about some of the ways people at the time were writing about the Saturday Evening Post, for example, a few years after this trip. It described El Zeta as the first woman to run the Grand Canyon. Didn't say anything about Lois. And it mentioned how El Zeta was getting old and hadn't married and that her life was passing her by and that she was this aging spinster with an empty life. I mean, that I thought that was sad.
Devastating, right?
Yeah.
Devastating. Yeah, yeah. I mean, El Zeta wrote to Lois about that article and just you can hear the devastation. You can hear her fury, you know. She was so frustrated that she was being remembered that way and not being remembered for this important botanical work that she did. Mm-hmm. She always wanted her legacy to be in botany as a scientist, to be taken seriously as a scientist. And I think she, more than Lois, you know, Lois had went on a path where she did get married and she did have kids. But because El Zeta didn't do that, she really ended up kind of the butt end of jokes in the press. Mm. And other river runners would talk about her that way in this really disparaging way. To be honest, I think that was a frustration for her entire life. I think it was a shadow that hung over her that she was never taken seriously as going on this trip to do the botany. Even her own colleagues teased her about how she was just a daredevil and she wanted to take these wild risks, you know? So I'm hoping the story changes that.
Yeah. If you want to understand how, as people start to get into, you write about how people start getting interested in not just running the river, but saving the river and thinking about what is this dam doing to the ecology? How has it transformed that place? And if you want to understand how the dam was really changing the river, you need to know what it was like, as you say, before all of that. And so there's this group in 1994 who say, let's go to the people who knew the river before the dam. And this is what gets Lois back on the river. Talk about this expedition. Because unlike El Zeta, she goes back.
She does get to go back, yeah. And that's a kind of a satisfying way, I think, to wrap up the story because she gets to go back and be taken seriously as a scientist, you know, with a really unique perspective on this river ecology. So this group from the U.S. Geological Survey was involved in kind of this process to look at ways that we might operate Glen Canyon Dam differently. We could operate it in a way that would maybe protect and restore at least some fraction of its ecology, which is not something people were talking about in the 1960s when the dam was first finished. So it was kind of being applied after the fact in the 90s. And, you know, they were doing all kinds of research about, well, what did it used to look like before the dam? And one of them kind of struck upon this idea, why don't we ask people who saw it?
Yeah.
So they convened this trip. They called it the Old Timers Trip. And they invited back a bunch of people who had run the river before the dam went in. And they were all old timers. At this point, Lois Jotter was in her 80s.
Wow.
And they invited her back. And she was the only one who was, of course, a botanist. And so she really had a unique perspective and expertise to lend to this expedition. And they took this group down the Grand Canyon for 2 weeks and asked them questions along the way about what they were seeing as kind of a way to sort of truth, you know, it was like a ground truthing of what they were discovering in other kinds of research. All of that research and those ideas led directly to a program that we have now at Glen Canyon Dam, where they release these big floods from the dam periodically in order to help rebuild the sandbar. So it had an influence on the way that dam is managed.
You say that one of the things that Lois notices on that trip was that the more she thought about it, this is how you put it, the more she realized that nothing was the same. That the river, as you say, wasn't a wild place. Now it was, this is how you write in the book, a muscle of energy to turn hydroelectric turbines, a 1,000-plus-mile-long ditch to deliver water to cities and farms, or a playground for tourists.
Yeah, and that part about nothing being the same is directly from Lois herself, from her own writing about this trip afterwards. The vegetation was different, you know, the ecology was different. Certainly the experience of running the river was incredibly different.
Yeah.
You know, nothing had really stayed the same except for the geology. You know, yeah, it was fascinating for me to be able to see it through her eyes both those times, you know, in the 30s and in the 90s, and to know how profoundly we've affected that ecology. And yet the ecology is still there. It's still thriving. Yeah. And I think it's still worthy of our attention and our respect and our protection.
Well, and this is, I think this is an important part because you ask this question in the book. What does wild mean anyway? What do you mean by that? Because you say a wild place isn't one that's untouched by humans. It's this is how you say it. You say it's a place that changes us.
I wrote the conclusion in the Grand Canyon, actually, and I didn't know I was going. I didn't know that's where I was headed with the story. You know, the word wild is right in the title, right? The idea that this was this wild place that these two women got to experience in the 30s. But as I learned about the river through their eyes, you know, I saw how there's a long human history in this place. You know, the plants themselves, many of them have been cultivated and shaped by the indigenous people of this region. You can see that in the botany. And then you can see all the changes that have come in since, you know, colonization of the region. You can see what the dams have done and the non-native species have done. And I think, you know, I was in the canyon on my trip. I hadn't yet written the conclusion of the book. And those words came to me as I was down there. I was trapped in my tent on a rainy day, and I had a scrap piece of paper. And I felt very powerfully in that moment that this idea of wild, that it's this thing out there, you know, that it's this idea, this like pristine place, that that has never been true. And what we really mean when we talk about wild and wilderness, we're talking about the effect that it has on us when we're there experiencing it. And I think that little shift in perspective is going to help us understand that we can still fight to protect places that have been drastically changed, and we should still fight to protect them.
You say that those women took with them when they went to that river this new perspective, that rather than seeing the river as men had before for its potential to, you know, to be harnessed for human use, they saw something else. They saw it as a living system, and that's a different way of seeing it, I guess, of course.
Yeah, I was really struck by that because I weave into the story some of the stories of expeditions that had come before them, you know, people like Robert Brewster Stanton, who, you know, wanted to build this gold dredge and like dig up the gold and, you know, was mapping out this railroad along the side of the river, you know, people who had come really with these ideas of how to dam it or harness it in some way for kind of, you know, an economic use. And that was really, you know, the expeditions that had come before them, that's what they were doing. They were like, how do we like monetize this river? How do we make use of it? And I was really struck that they were kind of the first really to come along that were just looking at it, you know? Like, they just wanted to see what was there and write it down and record it. And I think that was an incredibly profound shift in perspective and one that was really needed.
Elzeta says this thing to Lois. She didn't want the drama. Like, she wanted someone to tell a story of that trip that didn't involve the drama, that didn't focus on their gender, but, as she told Lois, was, as she said, a calm, true, and dignified account of the trip as a grand adventure. And it occurred to me that's what your book is. That's what you've done.
Thank you. I hope so. I found that quote really late in the writing. I was almost completely done with the book when I found that quote where she was complaining about how her story had been told and saying, like, she really wants an account of her adventure that was true to what she was trying to do as a botanist. From the start, that is the account that I wanted to tell, and it was strange to find that quote and feel like Elzeta Clover was speaking directly to me, asking for this to happen.
Melissa Savigny, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
That's Melissa Savigny. She reports on science and technology for the public radio station KNAU in Arizona. Her book is Brave the Wild River, the untold story of two women who mapped the botany of the Grand Canyon. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.